Hi everyone, my name's Jane and I'm an alcoholic. I'm so happy to be here. First of all, I wanted to tell you something. Tomorrow is my 60th birthday. In many ways, I was like, all my friends were saying, what are you doing for your 60th birthday? And it's like, oh, you know, I'm going to this convention, you know. They're like, convention? And I'm like, yeah, you know, and they're like, oh man, 60's big. You should have had them take you to Aruba or something, you know? And I'm like, oh yeah, that would have been nice. But I am so glad that I'm here and surrounded by my family and my friends. And, you know, I love that the name of this is Woodstock, because in many ways I wish I was 10 years older so that I could have been at the real Woodstock. Because let me tell you, I have rock and roll in my blood. And, oh, by the way, my makeup birthday gift from James is he scored 12th row seats to Bruce Springsteen. Okay, that's pretty big stuff. So, but anyway, now I can finally say I've been to Woodstock. Yeah. But really, it truly is a blessing to be here. And I have so many, I love Gratitude Month, too. You know, a month that we all get together for gratitude dinners, and of course Thanksgiving is next week. But I give so much thanks to everybody who got me to where I'm at today, to the sponsors that I've had throughout the years, to my faith, to my family, who, you know, at one point did give up on me, but has welcomed me back into the fold. And to, you know, my amazing husband, who you all just heard. I mean, let me tell you, James is one of the kindest people I've ever met, and I think you can all sense that after just having heard his talk. And he just really encompasses love, very much like his mother. You know, they both are just love incarnate. And I'm not saying that to be corny, because I'm the one who's the feisty one in our relationship. I'm the one who's like the fire. James is the calm in the storm, always. And I just am so grateful to have heard his story. And every time he tells it, he changes it up. And every time he tells it, I take away something different. So I would just love for everyone to just give my amazing husband another hand. But anyway, thanks to all those people, I've been sober since September 24th of 1996. Woo! Yeah! And I want to thank Dick and Barbara for inviting us. You know, I shared yesterday a big thank you. It's really cool to be here as a family, you know, and it's kind of got the family vibe. I mean, everyone here is family, right? But I'm glad that you see that vision, because it's always great to get asked to speak with my husband and my mother-in-law. It's really an honor. I also want to thank so many people, but also Bob and Linda, who were on the panel yesterday. That was a lot of fun. Dave, who's not here, our speaker on Friday night was amazing. I love you, Mildred. You've been an inspiration to me through the years. And Ralph, thank you for your amazing talk last night. You know, and it's really nice to see you two here as a couple too. You know, with many of you know Leslie, who's been, you know, just a wonderful voice. And, you know, and I don't know, again, I'm just so, oh, and oh my gosh, Linda and Clint are one of my other favorite couples. And I got news for you, Linda, it was me who asked for you to be. But I believe that in every single AA, right under the surface is an Al-Anon. I really believe that. So I'm also so glad when there are, you know, conventions that really celebrate together the spirit of Al-Anon and AA. So, and again, thank you, Dick, for making that happen. I want to thank Lee and Josh for doing their deal over there. Everybody show them the love. I don't think there's any greater gift than the gift of somebody's story. You know, I know early on in my sobriety, those tapes saved my butt, You know, I'm one of those alcoholics that lost my license for life. And so when I couldn't, you know, get to a meeting, I actually had worked it out with my probation officer that I could listen to an AA tape. And he, of course, wanted to know who the speaker was, and I had to write that down, too. But anyway, again, I feel like what you guys do is a vocation and a calling, and I just wanted to, you know, to share that. So anyway, I just always like to share out of the gate that my drinking run lasted 14 years, and I'm so glad that we're all here together again in person. Oh, my gosh, I've missed this. I've missed the fellowship, the love that's in all the rooms. And I miss celebrating this incredible spiritual program, this non-religious program, that we're all on this pathway to seeking, you know, spiritual guidance. And I don't know about you, but I know that, you know, while I get a lot out of the speakers, I also love hearing the stories of you all while we're here. You know, James and I took a walk yesterday and we heard, you know, an amazing story of a young man who's getting sober through AA, but also his collegiate recovery program. You know, I've also heard stories of friends that I haven't seen in, you know, quite some time. And anyway, that's where I really get fed is, you know, hearing your stories too. Really, anybody could be up at this podium, you know. You know, my story's no more important than any of yours, and I love the fact that we get to share those at conventions like this. Yeah, and how lucky are we that we have this set of spiritual principles and spiritual practices that we can incorporate into our lives during times of difficulty. You know, I know a lot of us have experienced a lot of loss, a lot of pain, a lot of grief over the last couple of years, myself included. But as James said, it's so affirming to know that not only is everything going to be okay, everything is okay. And now that we're coming out of things, I'm really seeing the valuable lessons that I learned over the last 2.5 years. A lot of valuable lessons. Think about the ones that you've learned just for a moment. You know? But the biggest thing that I've learned is that when I continue to live in the present moment, all of my fears are kept at bay. Isn't that funny how that happens? And if you want to be peace, or if you want to feel peace, you should just be peace. Be a walking example of somebody who's not in chaos, not in panic, just in a state of peace, knowing that God is in charge. You know, And I don't know about you, but for me, until the pain got strong enough, I wasn't going to change, you know. So I'm grateful for even the bad things in my life that have happened, because all of them have helped me grow into the person that I am now. And I love to live by the spiritual principle that when you give, you get back. And I've gotten so much so far so out of this weekend, but I'm up here just as a humble servant, you know, here to offer you my story in the hope that it helps somebody to get that much closer to healing. You know, I honestly believe that it's all because of grace. And I want to just talk about grace for a couple moments, too, and invite grace into the room. You know, grace has nothing to do with anything that we've done, anything that we've had to gain, anything that we haven't done. Grace is just always there for the taking. You know, it's almost like I like to explain it as this, like, beautiful current that's just flowing through life. And all we really have to do is tap into it. And it offers us things like forgiveness, light, illumination. You know, it's this ever-present inner realization that no matter what, we are one with God. I mean, how amazing is grace? You know? Grace finds beauty. Grace finds goodness in everything, in everyone. You know, so just sit for a moment and think about right now, all you have to do is tap into that and what a gift it is. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and get started. The way that I thought that I would do this is I'd share my story, and then when I get to steps four and five, when I did steps four and five, I'll just elaborate on it a little more than I usually do. And I'll just share from my heart, and I hope that's what you hear from me today, is I'm speaking to you from the language of my heart. I'm no pro at doing step work, you know. I can just share with you my experience doing it. And before I begin, I too am nervous, but I really love that phrase that the will of God will never take us where the grace of God won't protect us. Okay, so anyway, here I go with my story. My home group is Central Group in Tallahassee, Florida, and I come from a big Irish Catholic family. You probably can hear in my voice, I'm not from Florida originally. That's why I get so excited about Bruce Springsteen. I'm from the great state of New Jersey. Yeah! And, you know, and I gotta tell you, I am so grateful for where I was raised and how I was raised. You know, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. My parents have been married for 64 years, and they still live in the house that I grew up in. So every time when I go home to visit, which now I'm making every 2 months or so, because my mom's 87, my dad's 91, I still sleep in my childhood bedroom. Can you believe that? I mean, it's so cool. But, and it really gives me the chance to reflect on how blessed I was to have the childhood that I had. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad, I always share this story about my dad, because I'm really proud of him, but also it says a lot about the way that we were raised. And I'm going to share a little bit of a different story because, for Bob and Linda, because I remember when I first met you, it was like about 10 years ago or something. And you'll get the coincidence in a moment. But anyway, I was sharing, as I sometimes do, that my dad was actually favored to be the first ever to break the 4-minute mile in track and field. And he missed it, ready? 4.00.02. Can you imagine? So the New York Times does the 10 greatest moments in Madison Square Garden once a year. And an event that my dad was in always makes that list. So here's what happened. Madison Square Garden back in the day was full. Sporting events were big, especially track and field, right? And so this was supposed to be like this world record-breaking race. And it was my dad and the two other greatest contenders to do this in this race. Madison Square Garden was like on fire with anticipation. As a matter of fact, there's a picture of the starting line, and right in the background is Joe DiMaggio and Rocky Graziano, and, you know, all these big athletes are there for this, you know, amazing race that's about to take place. So anyway, the final lap comes, and it's the top three. My dad's in second place, the guy in first, and the guy in third, right? So they're coming around the runway, and my dad goes to overtake the guy in first, and the guy elbows him off the track, and that's like an automatic disqualification. So my dad, feisty little Irishman from Brooklyn, you know, gets back on the track, catches up with him, grabs his shorts, and they start fighting on the track. And the guy in third blows right by and breaks the world record. And legend has it that Madison Square Garden was shocked into silence. They couldn't believe what they had just saw. And my grandfather, who's a boxer from Brooklyn, says, "All right, Freddie, take him out back and finish him off." But I share that because that's the spunk, that's the spirit that my dad put in all of us. And I wanted Bob and Linda to know that when I shared at that convention, this woman came up to me afterwards and she said, "My uncle was the guy that your dad was with." I mean, what a small world, right? So anyway, but I share it too because that was the sense of focus and discipline and, you know, hard work that my dad instilled into all of us. And most of us used it in productive ways. You know the way that I used it. I mean, when it came to my party and I was determined, I was focused, I was organized, I took it to the limit. I broke records, you know? And I'll tell you a little bit more about that when I get into my story. But you get the drift. I come from a really good family. I went to Catholic schools. I went to Catholic elementary school, an all-girl Catholic high school, and a Catholic college. And as James said, I really am grateful for the Catholic upbringing that I had, because really I know the difference between right and wrong. You know, AA didn't really teach me anything new about that. I knew when I was, you know, taking a detour from the path that I was supposed to be on. But anyway, and I'll tell you something, the nuns that I had, oh my gosh, they were the first feminists I ever met. They were activists, they were, you know, they were really cool. They really instilled in all of us to never depend on anyone else, to get your education because it's power, and to be independent and never rely on anyone else, right? And so I feel really blessed that I had the influence of them, and I had a lot of great priests in my life too, in sobriety as well, and I'll tell you about that as well. But anyway, I always believed in God. There was no doubt that there was a God in my life. You know, but when I hit my rebellious years, which happened when I was 14 is when I took my first drink, I knew that I was going off the wayside, but it was pure rebellion. It was that defiance that James talked about. It was me, you know, pushing boundaries and me, you know, kind of finding myself in this crazy world that we live in, because the way that I was raised, you were supposed to, you know, get married and have kids, and that was the key to happiness. I shared it yesterday, and I wanted to see the world. I wanted to travel. I wanted to date a lot of guys. I wanted to experience it all, do it all. You know, and so I began that path actually when I went to college. But my first drink was when I was 14, and it was actually the my 18-year-old cousin and a bunch of her friends took me to the movies with them, and they had two bottles of rum, and they kept dumping them into our Coca-Colas. And I remember taking that first sip and just like, oh my God, this is so cool. And the movie was the original Star Wars. So I was sitting in my seat just like, woo, oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. And I was flying around intergalactically with Han Solo on that Millennium Falcon thing. And I was just, I mean, I was just having the time of my life. I loved it. And that was like cutting edge stuff back in the day. You know, recently I watched it and I was like, really? That was cutting edge stuff? But anyway, you know, it was just, that is what the imprint that it left on my brain was, this, you know, out of this world, out of this galaxy experience, you know, where it was almost like plain Jane was gone forever. Enter extraordinary Jane. And I took that with me everywhere I went. It was like, you know, I wanted people, when I walked into a room, I wanted people to be like, oh yeah, the party's about to begin. James here, you know? And that's what I went for every single time I drank. And I gotta tell you, I was a good kid in high school. My drinking didn't start until I went to college. You know, that I had that first experience, and then a couple little, you know, smoking weed and drinking when I was in high school, but, you know, not like we hear some people. Like some people when, that's why I love hearing all the stories, but some people say that they felt comfortable in their own skin the first time they used. Not me. I already felt comfortable in my own skin. I wanted to just take it to the next level. And that's, you know, I believe when you do that long enough and hard enough, that the neurocircuitry in your brain is going to change and become accustomed to needing that. And that is the story of my alcoholism. I did it long enough and hard enough to the point where I, you know, lost control, and it was on. Now, I went to college, I went to Manhattan College in New York City in the 1980s. And let me tell you something, it's a sheer miracle that I made it through the 80s and I'm here this morning. You know, I always like to sing, I'll sing this one for you, Lisa. You know, it was like that Eagles song. It was everything, all the time, life in the fast lane. You know, what was the beginning of it? Eager for action. action, hot for the game. You know, that was me. I had it on. I had it going on. The kids today call it FOMO, fear of missing out. And I was out every night. My dorm was at, I was at 242nd Street in Broadway, so I had access 24/7 to the biggest, baddest city on earth in the 80s, right? And, you know, we're not supposed to have an opinion on outside issues, but I have one. I absolutely loved them. I love smoking weed. I love snorting cocaine. I love doing pills. I mean, I did anything that would lead me to party and drink longer and harder and faster. And really, that's that. The drugs actually amplified my drinking. Believe me, I'm all about singleness of purpose, and drinking far and away is the love of my life, right? But yeah. So I was living this rock and roll lifestyle. As a matter of fact, you name the band, I saw them at Madison Square Garden. I actually partied with quite a few of them, okay? And you know, I mean, I wanted people to look at me and say, you know, if I had to explain myself in one sentence, I was just a rule-breaking, risk-taking, hell-raising, rock and roll chick, wow, wanting to live that rock and roll lifestyle. You know, and I did my best to do that. So anyway, it caused a lot of problems with my schoolwork, as you can imagine. And I had, I'm going to try to keep my story abbreviated, but I had a lot of geographic changes. And I kid you not, every single one of them I met with all my heart and soul, like, okay, I'm going to straighten out my act, clean slate, nobody knows me here, fresh beginning, you know. And every single time I just, you know, fell right back into the same pattern. And so my first geographic change is when I was a junior in college. I was like, man, you know, New York's killing me. I'm ready for a change. And so I had the opportunity to go study in France for a semester. And again, clean slate, nobody knows me. Well, I moved to France and they had a 19-year-old nanny living with them. And we tore up that city of Nantes, just like I was tearing up New York. You know, I was able to backpack through Europe that summer, and you know, I had the greatest time. Oh, my gosh. But the lesson that I learned was everywhere I went, I magnetized party people, you know. I mean, we really do. We know each other when we come across each other. And, you know, that's just how we roll. And when I got back, you know, I finished off my last year of college, and I ended up being a high school teacher. I taught English and French, and I moved to a city called Hoboken, New Jersey, which, by the way, Hoboken is 1 square mile, and it has the most amount of bars than any other 1 square mile area. It's in the Guinness Book of World Records, as a matter of fact. And so I got a job at an Irish pub at night, and I taught high school by day, and we know how that goes, right? The days turn into nights, the nights turn into days, and oh my gosh, and I was just out of control. I, you know, there were nights where I didn't even, you know, I just went home and showered, you know, loaded up my vodka cranberry, because they don't smell, right? You can't smell the booze, right? Yeah, right. And I would, you know, plop it in my car and drive to work, smoke some weed on the way too, and teach high school like that. Can you imagine? You know, it was a creative writing class, so, you know, that was okay. But still, I mean, it was insane. Remember overhead projectors? Well, you know what I used them for. You know? I mean, I was just doing crazy stuff. I had, and this is where my morals started to slip. I started dating a married teacher. And, you know, I mean, like I said, the good Catholic schoolgirl, right? You know, and all of a sudden I'm dating this married 38-year-old dude that is going through a major midlife crisis because he was doing all that crazy stuff with me. And, but anyway, when I got to that point, I felt like, you know, all of my morals started to slip away, you know, and this is really crucial because I want to make sure I explain it in the right way. I had nothing traumatic happen to me in my upbringing. Everything traumatic that happened to me happened as a result of my drinking. I mean, I remember thinking when I would black out, I'd be like, damn, that must have been a good time. I don't remember anything. You know, and I mean, it was just crazy. And the married teacher that I was working with, you know, that was a mess of a relationship. And by this time, my family stopped inviting me to family functions because I would always, you know, embarrass my parents. My siblings were just like, God, Jane. And I'm like, don't worry about it. I'm sowing my wild oats. I'll calm down when I get this, you know, all out of me. It was like almost, I had this mad urge to just do everything and then, you know, and then I was going to straighten out my act. Well, that seems to be a pattern in my life, and I never did straighten out my act for many, many years. As I said, 14 years, I was on a long, hard run. And I had a couple of other geographic changes. After Hoboken, and to get away from that married guy I was dating, I moved to Japan. And, I remember thinking, oh, God, Japan. I heard if you get caught with a joint in Japan, you go to prison for 7 years. So I'm going to stay away from drugs. I'm not going to drink. Forget it. I found all the same things that I was doing here over there, too. And I ended up going for just a year. I ended up staying for three because it was so easy to be an alcoholic over there. I taught English and basically worked for Time Life Educational Services. And, you know, and I'm going to mention this part of my story, too, because it also marks another step into my alcoholism. So I had to live in a training center with the Japanese businessmen for a month. They had to be totally immersed in English, right? So I had to eat breakfast, lunch, dinner with them. And every night we went out drinking and partying. And this is the stage in my life where first thing in the morning, I needed a drink. I couldn't wait to get to my dorm room to have a drink at lunchtime. And then at night, it was on. So I feel like it's, I wanted to mention this because that was my next step into, oh my God, I have a problem. It's not fun anymore. It's not cute anymore. Now, when it was happening, it was, but oh, the darkness started to set in with some of the things that were happening to me. I remember just sometimes waking up and feeling, you know, after maybe having semi-consensual experiences and thinking like, oh my God, I am so filled with shame and disgust. And, you know, I mean, and self-loathing, the only thing that would make me feel better was by picking up a drink. And then it kind of magically all went away, and it was fun, it was time to party again. And that became my cycle. That became my lifestyle for many years. So anyway, I want to just kind of get to what happened. I had a bunch of geographic changes, as I said. Let me tell you about the one that landed me down in Florida. So I got back from Japan. I got my first DUI almost right out of the gate. And I was like, oh, well, you know, all these times that I drank and drove, I knew I was going to get popped one of these days. So, okay, I lost my license for 6 months. And a friend of mine had a restaurant down in the Florida Keys. And I was like, oh, cool. I think I'm going to go to the Florida Keys and have that clean slate, start fresh, no drinking, no drugs, boom. I'm surprised the whole audience isn't laughing at that because the Florida Keys is not the place to do that, all right? So the Florida Keys is where I really hit that incomprehensible demoralization that so many of us have talked about, that so many stories include. I lost that job almost right out of the gate, and I just lost everything, really. I remember walking around. I was homeless. I remember walking around barefoot with a bottle of Popov vodka in my hand at all times. And, you know, forget about snorting cocaine. I was smoking crack. And I like to call these months my fade to black months. You know, it was like I didn't have the courage to take my own life, but I thought, oh, well, I'll just blow my heart up or something, or, you know, drink myself to death like Nicolas Cage in Leaving Las Vegas, you know. I'll just, you know, fade out into nothing. And again, I want to talk, I was sharing a little bit about my family yesterday on the panel, but it was almost like they were disgusted by me. I felt like they were just so filled with disgust and shame that I wanted to, like, just do things to get back at them. You know, do terrible things. It was almost like I wanted to do things at them, and I would, you know, I would get, like, I'd call and I'd hear the disgust in their voices, and I'd be like, oh, you think I'm that bad? Watch this. I'm going out. And I would do something that was really self-harmful in nature. And I just really fell into that dark stage that, you know, that I can't believe that I had that moment of clarity when I looked in the mirror and saw, like, an 85-pound skeleton staring back at me. I had the wherewithal to call a cousin of mine up in Fort Lauderdale. And I still can't believe she had three young kids under five, and she came and got me. And I really started to, you know, try and straighten out my act, but we all know how that goes. I don't know, I just was not happy. You know, I was still looking. James talked about what Mildred said, like looking for that thing that's going to fill you up. But instead, my hole just kept getting bigger and bigger and wider and more vast. And the hopelessness that I felt, knowing that I would never find anything. I mean, I tried it all. Sex, drugs, rock and roll. I mean, nothing was filling me up. It was just a really dark place to be. And so anyway, I met a guy, and he was actually living in Europe at the time. And he was getting these ex-adventure tour packages together in Europe, you know, where he would take people on, you know, like glacier climbing or mountain rappelling or cycling through Europe. They were called ex-adventure tours because they were, you know, kind of dangerous. And so our first date, we went skydiving. That says a little bit of something about him and, you know, the risk-taking thing that I was always so attracted to. And so, you know, this particular weekend that he was in town, he wanted to, you know, go down to the Florida Keys to check out the water sports. And I was like, oh God, the Florida Keys. Okay, let's go. All right. And we get down to the first key, and every tiki bar that we hit, we went in and had a load of drinks, and we got wasted. And we ended up in Marathon Key. And I remember, I had this great idea. Let's go down this old bridge road and watch the sunset. So we did that. You know, we had a bag of weed and a case of beer, and you know, we watched the sun come up, and it was really cool. And then we went out and partied again and went out dancing and, you know, whatever. And I had this other great idea. Why don't we go back to that bridge and watch the sun come up? That'll be cool. So that's what we did. And I remember going down the bridge road this time. Now, mind you, it's about 2-3 in the morning. I am wasted. And I see this sign that says authorized vehicles only. And I'm like, oh, well, vehicles, you know, let's go. And it looked different to me. Well, I was wasted, so of course it would. But I remember just proceeding down the road, and I remember saying to him, God, this is weird. It's like this road to nowhere. And it was right about when I said that where I went crashing, barreling right into the concrete barrier. Then on the other side was the water, you know. And oh my God, when I think back on how that, you know, that sound of the car smashing, and I opened my eyes and there was fire and smoke coming out, and I was just like, oh my God, Max, we gotta get out of here. The car's gonna blow. How are we gonna get out of here? How are we gonna get out of here? And I grabbed his hand and was trying to shake him. I figured he hit his head and he was just, you know, passed out. But it really didn't take long to figure out that, his hand was getting cold and that he wasn't breathing and that he was dead. Oh. And I remember thinking, oh my God, please just take me too. There's no way I'm going to be able to live with myself. You know, I remember saying all my prayers. I remember I had like this, I would go through phases of surviving and giving up, surviving and giving up. And I remember one time I was trying to get my foot out from under the brake, and I felt the bones in my ankle. And my whole left side was paralyzed because I broke my neck at C1, C2. By the way, that's the same fracture that Christopher Reeve broke his neck at. I remember my knees hit the dash, and so my pelvis was completely smashed. And I was just like, oh, my God, you know, we're never going to get out. I'm never going to get out of here. And I just kind of would, you know, resolve myself, okay, I'm just going to die, and perhaps that's a blessing. And then all of a sudden, I saw the blue lights in my rearview mirror, and I'm so grateful. At one of the court hearings down the pike, the police officer told me that he had a spiritual experience that night. He said it was literally like God tapped him on the shoulder and told him to back his police car up and go down that old bridge road. And he said the compulsion to do that was so real that when he saw the accident at the concrete barrier, it was like he almost wasn't even surprised. A lot of you might know that spot. It was actually in that movie True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where they blow up that bridge. And you know, I think the van is like hanging over it, and then a bird lands on the van. So he said he never went down that old bridge road. And you know, and I'm so glad he shared that with me, because in some of my darkest times, that was what I hung on to. Like, okay, God left me here for a reason. Now I got to figure out what that reason is. So, anyway, quickly, I want to talk about my, you know, the post-accident tragedy. I talked about my God that I had, my childhood God. Well, at this point in my life, I didn't have a God. I was void of any God. I mean, if there's a God, why would you do this to me? You know, deep down, you know I'm a good person. You know, I just didn't. I remember the Catholic priest coming into the room to give me communion, and I would be like, please, just turn around and get out of here. You know, it was a really, really dark time during those hospital days. And I was actually discharged after like 6 months. And my mom and dad stayed with me for about 3 weeks. And they pretty much said, just so you know, you're on your own. We were here to make sure that you made it through, but we're out of here. And I was like, I can't come back to New Jersey to get better. They're like, nope. Your friends meant so much to you. Let your friends take care of you. And they took off. And that was really painful for me. You know, it was like I lost my, and my mom was so angry. She was just like, you know, how could you do this to our family? How could you, you're going to give your father a heart attack. How can you do this to any of us? You know, she was just so, she said some really awful things, but she was gone. You know, I lost my mother. So it was like, I lost my boyfriend. I lost my mother. I lost my health. So anyway, I want to talk about, you know, when I got discharged from the hospital, I did have a friend who took me in St. Pete Beach, and the judge let me out on my own recognizance because I had to go through a bunch of physical therapy, and I was allowed to leave the house for that and to go to AA meetings. So I went to a 7 a.m. AA meeting every single day. And you people are the ones that saved my life during those dark times, man. Showed me some light, said stuff to me like, you know, there but for the grace of God. I can't tell you how many times I did stuff like that. Let me tell you, I'm so lucky that that didn't happen to me. And for some reason that like kind of made me feel a little bit better. You know, like in other words, they weren't judging me. It was a room of non-judgment. And I also heard a lot of things from you, like from step one, you know, stuff like, James did a great job on the first three steps, but in addition, he, highlighted honesty, and that's what really I took away from step one. Rigorous honesty, you know, I knew that I had to stop pointing the finger of blame at other people. I knew I had to accept 100% responsibility for what happened. I felt like I was a protected princess from all the harsh realities of life, and now I knew that that jig was up. I knew, you know, I was really facing the music this time. And so because of the rigorous honesty, I decided to go against what my attorney was saying, which was plead not guilty. And I was like, no, I'm guilty. I'm taking this on. Whatever. I need to do what I need to do to be honest for the rest of my life moving forward. And so I pled guilty and I got sentenced to 5 years in prison, followed by 10 years of probation. And I'm not lying when I tell you I'm grateful for the 5 years that I had in prison, you know. 10 years of probation, As a matter of fact, let me take a quick little brief aside. I got asked to share at a gratitude dinner a couple years ago down in the Keys. Can you believe it? And the woman who picked me up at the airport worked for the court system. And she told the judge that sentenced me that I was speaking at this AA gratitude dinner, and the judge came. Can you imagine? And, she, you know, I hugged her, and she hugged me, and I cried, and she cried. And I just said, thank you for saving my life. You know, I needed that 5 years. I needed to go on, like, this major mining expedition to find out who I was. I didn't know who I was without alcohol and drugs. So thank you. You saved my life. Now, the 10 years of probation I could have done without, but, you know. But anyway, and I joke with that, but really that saved my life too, you know. Because I shared yesterday, you know, when we get out of prison, we can either be empowered or we can get devoured, right? And because I had that probation, it kept me in that stage of empowerment and trying to get better and do better. And part of my probation, I got to mention right now, was to go to an AA meeting every day for 10 years. You know? You know, I'm grateful for that too. I lost my license for life, so it was tough getting to those meetings, so I moved right near the AA house in Tallahassee. And, you know, I rode my bike everywhere for, you know, 23 years. You know what I mean? So anyway, but let me get back to my, you know, getting sentenced to prison. And this is where I worked big time on my steps. Or I don't even know if working is a good word for that. Like, this is where I had the honor of engaging in the 12 steps. And the first step, as I just mentioned, the big takeaways were honesty and getting real and finding my true, authentic self by being honest with myself. And it took some time. And, you know, steps 2 and 3, James talked about too, you know, a lot of that was, you know, turning it over to this power that I really still was having a hard time initially believing in, you know. I love how Bob mentioned, you know, I love these little sayings. You know, it's all about, AA is all about giving up, cleaning up, making up, and growing up. Believe me, I hooked on to those really simple sayings because it sounded so complicated to me, you know. Another one of my favorite sayings is Winnie the Pooh. You know, what is recovery all about? Well, I get to where I'm going by walking away from where I've been. You know, I like these simple things, you know. And so, yeah, so everything, I just wasn't in the right state of mind to hear about this organized step stuff that I had to engage in early on. I just was so overwhelmed with what was happening to me. It was a process for me. So anyway, a couple of things happened to me when I was in prison that were substantial. And the first one has everything to do with step 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And I didn't do that, and again, I don't encourage this kind of behavior, but I didn't do that until I was like probably 2 years in prison. Because I was just trying to survive, you know? And my sponsor was really cool with it. I had my sponsor from St. Pete on the outside. And she just said, you know what, Jane, just keep, you know, keep getting through each day. Keep, you know, talking to me about things that are going on. And when you're ready, I think, you know, it'll happen. Now, again, we talk about this now, and she's like, I was just afraid to really make you do it because you were so on edge of everything, you know. And she goes, but I knew when the time was right, you know, it would happen. And really, when the time was right, the teacher appeared. And I had the opportunity to do an amazing fourth step. Now, let me tell you, it was fearless. I took a lot of time doing it. I had a lot of time. I was in prison, for God's sake, right? But I realized initially that I was stuck in guilt and shame. I was stuck. And that's what my sponsor said that really got me. She's like, you know what will get you unstuck is by writing it all down. So she told me how I was supposed to write it down, but I knew that I had to do it for a fifth step, too, so I didn't want to do it that way. So I said, you know what? I want to just write an autobiographical kind of thing because I want whoever's going to hear my fifth step to get me in context, you know, because I felt like just reading those lists, oh, my God, they would think I was this horrible, terrible person, right? So I set out to write my story, and I had a good time doing it because it was very revealing to see the tragic wake that I left in my trail of life. You know, seeing it there on paper was making me accountable for the first time ever, you know? And, you know, and they say steps 4 through 7 are getting it right with yourself, right? So that's what I was on this mission to move past my stuckness. And I always was told by my sponsor, always invite Grace in before you do any of this. So I started to really become friends with Grace and fall in love with Grace, you know? And from step 4, I gained self-knowledge. I saw who I was in black and white, you know? And I was really, after I started writing my story, I realized that this was the action part of the program. You know, steps 1 through 3 was a lot of thinking. This was action. So I took pen to paper and I just started writing. And I knew that I had to drop my ego and transcend to a place of humility like I was never in before. How humbling is it to write down all the terrible stuff that you've done and to see it on paper? But I remember my sponsor always said, always remember, too, to write the good stuff down as well. And I'm so glad she said that. She was like, remember, you're a child of God. You know, don't just concentrate on that bad stuff. You did a lot of good stuff, too. You're a good person, too. You know? So, anyway, I feel like I want to use James' image that he sometimes uses, like a candle in your soul. You know, I felt like that candle was out. But it wasn't, you know. I felt like that light was still on in my soul. And as a result of doing my fourth step, it just started to get brighter and brighter. And all those things that were blocking me from moving forward started to disappear. And I felt like even in prison, in this time of darkness, I was starting to see some light, you know. And the more I wrote, I saw more and more light. So anyway, then after I wrote my story, then of course I, you know, made my list of resentments, fears, guilt, sexual behaviors. And again, that was like, I'm glad I did the autobiography because a lot of it prompted remembering the stuff that I needed to put in that list. So I really, love step 4. I love the whole process of it. I am a big believer in journaling and writing and, you know, and so that's kind of how I do it with my sponsees as well. And I can tell you to this day, nobody wrote as long of an autobiography as I did, but still they enjoyed that part of it too. It was like just a reflection of the patterns in their life. And then when I moved on to step 5, you know, admitting to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, oh my gosh, that took humility to a whole new level. I went to Mass one Sunday, and there was a priest. His name was Father O'Brien. He doesn't mind that I share it. There are a lot of Father O'Briens that are out there, right? Yeah. Yeah, Mildred had a Father O'Brien in her story, too. And Father O'Brien's a cool dude, man. And as a matter of fact, he's 75 years old, and he just walked that 500-mile pilgrimage in El Camino or whatever. But he's an amazing person. And so anyway, after Mass, he said, "Ladies, I just want you to know I'm an alcoholic in recovery, and I talked to the warden, and I got permission to do fifth steps." And I was like, "Confession? Fifth step? Kill two birds with one stone? Sign me up," right? So I was all psyched to do my fifth step with him. And he was from New Jersey, too, by the way. And so anyway, I was looking forward to just getting all of that off my chest. It was just sitting here. And it was almost like a sacramental event that was about to take place with my fifth step. And I knew that if I did it the right way, that it would help me move past that feeling of being stuck. So, and I'm so grateful that I did it with Father O'Brien. You know, I remember the first thing he said to me is one of my favorite books is The Spirituality of Imperfection. And he said, basically what that book is all about is I'm not okay, you're not okay, and that's okay. And I was like, okay, yeah, all right. And he said, "Jane, I'm a priest. I've heard it all. Don't hold anything back. Be vulnerable. You know, do me a favor and receive forgiveness, but also give it too." You know, he talked all about God's mercy throughout. He was able to share those self-destructive patterns and point them out to me in the behaviors that were stopping me from putting trust in anybody anymore. And after I shared them, I'm telling you, my fears, my isolation, they just all fell away, and I felt this peace like I never felt before. Here I am in prison, and I felt freer than I ever felt before in my life. It was unbelievable. And I don't know about you, but it wasn't until I got to step 5 that I marked my return to sanity. You know? It freed my mind. It freed my heart. You know, I broke a lot of hearts. I broke a lot of laws, too. You know? But I just felt free of it all after doing that. And he didn't judge me. He cried when I cried. He showed me unconditional love and compassion. And I can't even tell you, the nature of all of my relationships changed after my step 5. I started opening up to, you know, to writing letters. I mean, I did that with my steps 8 and 9, too. I wrote a lot of letters, but it really gave me the strength and the confidence to do it. But after step 5, really, I let go and I let God. So anyway, I wanted to just share something from our literature. I loved this. This was so helpful for me. It's from page 72, 73 in the Big Book. "We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find necessary until they told someone else all their life story." Again, reading that gave me such faith and confidence that I would be able to move forward. You know, I'd be able to let go of that incredible guilt that I held on to for so long. you know, Bill Wilson deemed it absolutely necessary and foundational for our full recovery that we have a vital spiritual experience, a real transformation of the self. To me, that's the essence of spirituality right there. And I got that after step five. You know, how lucky am I? So anyway, I'm getting emotional talking about it, but I'm so grateful for the wisdom of our forefathers that saw the necessity of doing that. And, you know, and another thing that I always wanted to mention, in case anyone is stuck in their forgiveness, in self-forgiveness, is there was another priest when I was in prison, and I went to confession to him one time. And after confession, he started crying. And I was like, oh, my God, look at that. The priest is crying, you know. And then I realized they were tears of anger and frustration. And he said, Jane, every time you come to confession, you say the same sin over and over and over again. I'm sick and tired of hearing it. You know, who do you think you are, above accepting God's forgiveness? And I was like, that really hit me. He goes, I tell you, every time, you know, that sin is thrown out there into the sea of forgiveness, you keep on reeling it back in. Do me a favor. Don't come back to confession. Don't come back to Mass even until you forgive yourself. Better yet, until you start on the road of redemption. And I was like, whoa. But I'll tell you something. It was the brick that I needed to hit me in the head, you know. So, again, I'm so grateful for that. And also, after my fourth and fifth step, I started to see the beauty of uncertainty and the infinite possibilities that lay before me after my tragedy, you know. But first and foremost, I needed to rebuild my relationship with my family because they're the ones that mean everything to me. And slowly but surely, that happened over time, you know, but it took a lot of time. I remember my dad saying, the best apology is changed behavior, and we're not going to see that until you get out of prison. So, you know, let's hold off on that, Jane. And so anyway, I embarked on my journey after getting out for 5 years. I did rebuild my life, and I just have a couple minutes left, so I want to tell you how I did really rebuild my relationship with my family. Oh, my gosh. You know, my mom and dad are so proud of me. My siblings are so proud of me, you know. But, man, it took a long time. I got out of prison. I got a couple of minimum wage jobs, went back to grad school. I figured, what better way to serve God than love and service? So I went back and I got my MSW, and then I got licensed. So now I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I had many angels that believed in me on my journey of recovery. I went to all the meetings. I got, you know, I really made sure that I stayed connected with all of you. And I'll tell you something, the miracles, I said it yesterday, the miracles started to become my reality. And now after, I guess it was 2008, I got a call from the dean at the College of Social Work at Florida State University asking if I'd be interested in a full-time faculty position. I mean, can you believe that? That's like unbelievable. I remember when I got the job, I was saying to myself, 10 years ago right now, I was sitting on a prison bunk. And now I'm a professor at a major university. You know, doing what I love to do. That's what I mean by that, how that uncertainty can be your friend. If you just keep going in the right direction. If you lean into the doubt, it doesn't last very long, you know? It becomes certainty. You know, God will send you messages that you're on the right path. You know, and at times, we might not understand why things are happening. I alluded to that at the beginning. But as time passes, we realize that all the things that happened helped us to get where we are. And that's right here, right now, in this room, surrounded by a bunch of people in recovery, celebrating with joy, you know? I just want to close with a couple of recent, big examples of miracles in my life. I always like to share the first one, because when I got out of prison, I needed those signs. I needed to see them, man. And I remember, I told you, I lost my license for life. I had to go to I had to go to therapy once a month, and I had to go to an AA meeting every day. So I remember my therapist telling me, I got a carload of women going to an AA women's convention this weekend, and you're going. And I was like, oh, great, that sounds like a lot of fun. Like, I had no idea what conventions were, right? And this woman at the convention, the first speaker, got up behind the podium and laid it out, man. She was like, I couldn't believe the stuff that she was talking about. She's talking about how she was an alcoholic mom, neglected and abused her kids. I was like, wow, she's really got some courage to get up and do that. Well, guess what? That woman is now my mother-in-law. Can you believe, like, talk about the hand of God before I even knew it. And then the other great miracle is all the gifts of this program. I actually, one of the first times I shared my story at a big convention was 2009, the Florida State Convention. And I heard James tell his story. And when I heard him mention, like, Led Zeppelin and dropping out of school and, you know, moving to California, I was like, oh, man, me and that guy would have been dangerous back together, right? Yeah, back in the day. And so I remember when I went to thank him for sharing his story, when the person in front of me moved aside, I'm not kidding, I had, like, this love at first sight thing, like, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with this guy. Now, mind you, I've never been married before. I never even cohabitated with anyone before. And then I looked down and I saw a wedding ring on his finger. I was like, darn it, I'm wrong. That was wrong there. But we became Facebook friends. And I heard through the grapevine that somebody was saying, oh, Polly's so upset. Her son's going through this terrible, terrible divorce. And I was like, are you talking about James Lee? And she's like, they're like, yeah, you know, it's just been awful on everyone. And I was like, oh, that's too bad. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. And anyway, he lives in Chicago, and Polly, of course, is in Florida too. So, and then I got bummed because I heard he had a girlfriend. And then, the next thing I knew, he called me and said, hey, I'm visiting my mom. Can I come take you out to lunch? And he shared that that relationship was, ending. And, we've been together ever since. So, yeah. What a miracle. And I was 54, and I had the wedding of my dreams, let me tell you. So, and I was cool single. Don't get me wrong. I was totally cool single. This was just a major bonus. But yeah, and then really quickly, two other quick miracles. My mother has become my biggest advocate. And James always loves when I imitate my mother's voice, you know. But she's like, I can't believe, after all these years, you're still riding your bike everywhere. This is ridiculous. You know, what kind of justice system are we living in where, you know, you got hit by a car, you got hit by another biker. This has got to change. I'm going to start writing some letters to Governor Christie. So she starts writing letters to Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey, you know, like letter after. And, of course, the gatekeeper kept that, said, thank you for your letter, Mrs. Dwarves. I don't know. Well, finally, through some miracle, the letter ended up in the right hands, and I got a call from three of Christie's attorneys. And they asked me stuff. They were like, how many times have you drank and drove? And I was like, probably every time I drove for about 14 years. And there was like, boom, radio silence. I was like, but that rigorous honesty thing, I'm telling you, folks, I've never swayed from that. I always was straightforward and forthcoming about what happened to me. And so anyway, I got off the phone and I told James, I was like, I think I screwed that up, but oh well. Well, sure enough, his last night in office, 6 o'clock, New Jersey phone call on my phone. Hello, Jane, this is Governor Chris Christie from New Jersey. I was like, what? And he was like, listen, I just want to tell you, your mother is something else. I mean, I read everything, and I saw that you're all the great stuff you're doing. You make the great state of New Jersey proud. I see you're in that 12-step program that has saved so many of my loved ones' lives. I'm going to give you that pardon that'll forgive the first DUI, and it'll open up for you to have a hardship license. So I just started driving again, what, 4 years ago, after riding my bike everywhere for 23 years. And I was also able to vote in the last presidential election for the first time in 24 years. Can you believe that? It's unbelievable that, you know, that right was taken away from me. And I was I'm very much an activist for voter rights restoration. And I love that I'm in my social work circle, because I'm so inspired by so many of the activists that I work with, you know. And I'll tell you something, I love working with students. And I love being a support for the members of the LGBTQ community on my campus. I am the go-to professor when students are having issues with alcohol or drugs. And I also am like a resource, and I point them in the direction of where they can get treatment. So anyway, I hope that you got something out of my talk. I hope that if you're new, you know that it's never too late to be the person that God meant for you to be. And I am, you know, music has been such a part of my life, and I'm looking at Sonia right now because let me tell you something. Her music touches my heart. Like, music and poetry have been my best friend in some of my darkest hours. And every song that you've played today has touched my heart in a special place, touched some kind of chord that's still a little raw or something. But every song she sang made me cry. And how lucky. I mean, I look at her and I see gifts of God incarnate too. How lucky to have that musical genius that you have. So anyway, I am so happy to be in your midst. I want to thank everyone for listening to me Babylon for the last hour. And I want you to know, too, that I'm not perfect. But the thing is, I'll always strive to work on my imperfections. Thank you.